to John and Mara for accepting this paper, so it's great to be able to talk about this. I'm going to have to read it, I'm afraid. You know, you spend your life thinking about these things, and then you write it all down, and you find you're stuck to saying it. If I go off on an ad lib, I'll be lost. So forgive me for reading it. So I called it Wolf Kill. A few years ago, I was at this... Come in, Emma. It's all right. Stand on ceremony. So a few years ago, I was in this small workshop at the Minding Animals Conference in Utrecht. I don't know if some of you probably went there. And it was a small kind of workshop think session. And there weren't very many people in the session. And those that were there were all these sort of fairly radical animal liberationists, which there were a lot at the Minding Animals Conference. And the discussion we had in this small group, as usual, centered around who or what has the moral right to kill other animals. Clearly, for just about everybody in the room, as one might expect, humans do not have that moral right. But the question I want to think about is, what about other animals? And it was suggested at this meeting that the top predators, the kind of big cats, the wolves, should not be thought of as necessarily having a moral right either to hunt or to kill. The argument being, and it's quite well known as the predation argument, is that as sentient mammals, we might consider them, if you like, as moral agents, or at least the activities they undertake might have a moral component. And there's quite an interesting literature about whether animals could be considered as acting morally. Should these predators, we asked, be made aware of the suffering they cause their prey? Should they be persuaded to behave differently? Which is an intriguing, if rather impractical, course of action, if you're talking about lions and tigers and so on. However, within the context of today's conference, it does raise for me some interesting questions. Do animals, to play on the title, do animals only and always kill other animals in cold blood? Are humans uniquely able to kill in warm or in hot blood? And if we humans intentionally kill other animals, human or otherwise, in cold blood, are we acting like an animal? Now, we might disagree with a lot of my Utrecht colleagues about whether there is a genuine moral problem in lions killing zebras in the wild. But we might nonetheless hold that there is something morally wrong with well-fed domestic cats killing garden birds, or carnivorous wild animals in zoos feeding off live animals, or indeed reintroduced predators killing domesticated farm animals. It does seem to me these are moral questions. So there's something about these categories which raise issues of moral inquiry. Now, farm animals, of course, should be killed humanely. That, in a sense, is the supposed contract we've made with them, or at least with ourselves. However, in some places, and the example I'm going to play with is the French Alps, domesticated farm animals occasionally have their throats ripped out by wild wolves. Now, such attacks clearly upset the order of things. They're always frequently described in the French media as cold-blooded attacks. They deny the sheep the humane and more often pre-stunned death that they might come to expect from the processes of animal husbandry. Hence, the sheep's killability, if you like, is redefined. And although farmers, certainly in France and in Sweden and elsewhere, are compensated for the loss of the sheep killed by wolves, the sheep are never compensated for the shift in the manner of their dying. So how can the wolves, if you like, be persuaded to respect the sheep and permit them a humane death? Now, wolves kill. We revere them for it. They are iconic killers. Iconic killers of innocent babes and shepherdesses and grandmothers. They're the stuff of both... I've got a little picture here somewhere. Yes, there we are, some shepherdesses and their grandmothers. But, you know, they are key carnivores. They're the stuff of fairy tales and extermination programs. Key carnivores, no wolf, if you like, would eat a quiche or a salad. They eat what they kill. They're not scavengers. They're opportunistic carnivores, quickly adapting their dietary habits to what is around. They hunt in packs, bringing down their prey by classically biting into the hindquarters to immobilise, and then characteristically ripping out the neck and the throat. They kill what they need, though they may often leave a carcass to come back to it later. They have big teeth. The worst kinds of wolf are hairy on the inside, they say in that wonderful film, Company of Wolves, based, as I'm sure you know, on the work of Angela Carter. Wolves then are iconic killers, iconic predators. Paradoxically, perhaps, they're also iconic in other words, in other ways, too. Peter Singer, as you probably know, challenges the notoriety of the wolf in his book Animal Liberation, offering the wolf as a celebration of animality, highly social, devoted partners for life, only ever killing to eat. How much better the wolf is at being an animal than we are. Wolves have more recently become symbols and icons of species reintroduction programs in the US and in the European countries. Some even talk of Scotland. The reintroduction of wolves has become a cause for celebration. Following years, even centuries of hunting and ultimately extermination, in the UK we got rid of the last wolves around 1760, wolves have been hunted to extinction in many parts of the US. Now the wolves are back in the US, moving south through Oregon and California to the outskirts of Los Angeles. They've recently returned also to the southeast of France, particularly to the Mercantour National Park, which I kind of globally highlighted here, right in the southeast corner near the Italian border. Right next to Italy, which is supposedly their sort of pays d'origine, where they come up from to recolonize. They've returned clandestinely across the frontier, though for some of the farmers and opponents of the wolf, they were actually brought across in the back of ecologists' vans, but there's some dispute over that. And from the Mercantour National Park, they've spread north, and the latest map from the French ministry shows their presence now from 1994 right to 2004. They're right up now in Strasbourg at the very sort of gates of the European Parliament. And as they move through France, the wolves kill and eat what is available. So evidence from their scat, from their droppings, and here's some poor sod collecting wolf droppings from the snow in the Mercantour Park. Evidence from this suggests a very varied diet, from the mountain goats of the Alps to the smaller mammals of the French northern forests. As key carnivores, of course, they've got no real competitor in all of this. But the one key denominator, the one common denominator in the diet of these French wolves is sheep. Domestic breeds raised traditionally upon upland pastures for their milk, their wool, and their meat. Now, wolves kill around 1,500 sheep per year in France, and the number is rising very fast. Rarely do these kills involve a single sheep. Wolves typically hunt in groups, resulting in three or four sheep being taken by a single pack. On occasion, farmers claim entire sheep flocks have been panicked into running over a cliff or a precipice by a group of wolves, resulting in kind of multiple sheep deaths, and of course multiple compensation for all those sheep killed. Within the Mercantour National Park, if I went back to that little map, remember in the southwest corner, which, as I said, is the kind of centre of the historic recolonisation by the wolves, over 5,000 sheep were killed between 1994 and 2002. A further 829 killed indirectly by panic or by falling. And over 1,500 have actually survived a direct wolf attack. Now, although the number of sheep attacked each year is significant and is rising, of course we need to set that in context. The 1,500 a year wolves killed each year in France, we might set that against the 100,000 sheep and lambs killed by wild or domestic dogs, for example. Or we might set it against the 10 million sheep each year killed in French abattoirs. So when we talk about 1,000, 2,000 sheep killed each year by the wolves in France, we're talking very small numbers relative to the other forms of killing. However, the small number of wolves that there is in France makes this a relatively high kill ratio, i.e. the number of sheep killed per number of wolves, when compared with other EU states in which the wolves are also present. Recent estimates by the French Ministry of Agriculture, drawn again from the analysis of this wolf scat, suggest that on average in the mountain regions of the southeast of France, where the large numbers of wolves are found, domestic sheep make up between 21 and 40% of the diet of these predators. Obviously, there's a distinct seasonal pattern. Most of the kills will take place in summer because that's when the sheep are up there grazing. However, there are areas, even within the Mercantour National Park, where this figure rises to over 50% of the diet of the wolves is coming from domestic sheep, and that across the entire year, which suggests a much more aggressive predation in the lower slopes of the Alps, in and amongst the villages and the overwintering facilities, if you like, of the wolves. Now, of course, wolves have always attacked and eaten sheep. It's an integral part, if you like, of the classic wolf mythology. Here, though, the situation is particularly complicated. For a start, the wolves have been reintroduced, or at least their natural reintroduction has been greatly assisted by the movement of the ecologists and indeed by the National Ministry of Ecology. Additionally, these wolves have been reintroduced into an area that is not only rich in wild ungulate biodiversity, because it's a national park, and biodiversity is high on the agenda, but is also an area of open grazing, pastoral livestock farming systems, involving highly domesticated sheep herds who are singularly unused to the presence of a large predator. As farmed animals, the husbandry and the slaughter of these sheep is, of course, strictly regulated. An array of measures, both national and European, are in place to minimise the suffering of these sheep at slaughter, including the lairage and raceway management, the mandatory pre-stunning of the sheep before their throats are cut, handling rules and so on within the slaughterhouses. In short, the zone co-occupied by the wolves and the sheep is a zone where two very different moral regimes would seem to operate. The one referring to the right of the wild wolves to hunt, kill, and eat wild animals. The other referring the conditions under which we give ourselves the right to farm and look after domesticated animals. So when the wolves attack and kill the sheep, the moral regimes, if you like, are transgressed. Wolf kill becomes a cruel and unusual death for these farmed sheep. Now, the sheep are very easy prey for the wolves. We might think of them as kind of meat on rather short and not very good at running legs. Domesticated sheep do not expect to be eaten by wolves. They're either fatally unaware of the wolves' presence, that sort of instinct, if you like, has almost been bred out of them. They're accustomed to a world where there are no predators. Or if the flock has already survived an attack, which is becoming increasingly frequent, they're just a destabilised bundle of collective nerves. Little helped by equally nervous shepherds, most of whom are very young or have no experience of wolves, or by very unaggressive guard dogs. Sheep belonging to a flock that has been attacked by wolves display exaggerated vigilance behaviour, always looking up, and nervousness, which can affect their feeding and their growth. It can affect their reproductive status and their ability to care for their lambs. Sheep that have been attacked or have been witnessed an attack in their flock show signs of depression. They may be reluctant to remain in the open areas but will seek cover at whatever cost, which in the higher alpine areas is far more difficult to find. Indeed, when it is found, the sheep are more prone to fly strike, mosquito bites in the wooded areas, creating additional health issues, and the weakened animals then become inevitably more prone to easy predation. So what can we draw from this kind of scenario in terms of the objectives of this workshop? For the farmers and the shepherds, the introduction of the wolves, and to a large degree the encouragement of this reintroduction by the ecologists, by the ministry, and of course by a predominantly urban population attracted to a more sort of genuine wild aesthetic in these areas. For these actors, this is a cold-blooded and state-supported sacrifice of their sheep for some supposedly greater eco-aesthetic good. The compensation they receive for each sheep killed, coupled with the interdiction to shoot the wolves, only reinforces their sense that the life and death of the sheep, as well as their responsibilities of care, count for relatively little if a wolf is involved. For the sheep, the presence of the wolf has turned these landscapes of genteel grazing and bucolic bonhomie into landscapes of fear, to use that wonderful expression from Landré and others. For the other wild ungulates of this mountain area, the sheep present a welcome alternative to themselves as wolf prey. For the wolves, sheep are easy, particularly domesticated ones. The principal limitation on their consumption is simply the seasonality of their presence. Though as the farmers as the farmers respond by grazing their animals closer and closer to habitation, what actually happens is the wolves become more adventurous in coming into the villages, and we can see what's going to happen one day. So going back to that conversation we had at Utrecht, can we, and indeed should we, persuade the wolves to leave the sheep alone and let them die a more controlled, welfare-friendly death in a humane slaughter facility? Fences can be built, but how do you fence a forest and a lake of which there are thousands? Large dogs can be brought in, particularly... Oh, sorry, I've got a picture of a wolf kill. I shouldn't have that up through most of what I've been saying. There's a picture of a wolf kill. But I wanted to talk about these wonderful dogs, you know, the Patou, the French, the Great Pyrenees Mountain Dogs that Donna Haraway talks about so extensively in the Companion Species Manifesto. The trouble is with these dogs is they don't attack wolves, they attack tourists. And this is proving to be quite a problem for the management of the national park. Apart from anything else, they're very unaggressive with regards to the sheep. So the sheep don't get to learn about responding to an aggressive potential predator. We could move the sheep. The sheep could be moved, as I said, kept on lower pastures or housed all year round indoors. But this would, it is claimed, be a social and economic disaster as the quality of the production chain is closely linked to the idea of being in a natural wild environment. Selective culling of the wolves is a solution favoured in other countries, notably in the US and Yellowstone, but also in Sweden. But interestingly, recent research from some behavioural animal behaviourists shows that actually culling is more likely to increase sheep predation because the social groups are broken up and multiply, and so there are more social groups looking to kill the wolves, rather like we've seen with the badgers, the current badger culling procedure. Experiments in actual dissuasion by feeding wolves sheep meat that's been laced with nausea-inducing chemicals has been tried as well in the US particularly, but it's impractical to do it in Alpine France. No, the wolves are here to stay, and that seems likely. We must either continue to make sacrificial lambs of our sheep, or we must provide the wolves with an alternative food source. The former solution speaks of a peculiar form of hierarchical speciesism that actually offers little comfort for the sheep, though we might argue that in targeting the weaker sheep in a flock, the sort of habitual predation strategy of the wolves are really merely assisting the shepherd in what otherwise might be considered as management culling. What about providing an alternative food source? In this recreated and reassembled wild, the natural prey of the wolves, of the wild mouflon, chamois and chevreuil of the Alpine Arc. Perhaps their numbers should be increased artificially through breeding programs. And where these animals prove too nimble or sturdy for wolf predation, maybe their natural resilience should be artificially reduced. But there's something strangely paradoxical, I think, in all of these proffered solutions. If this is a wild space, then why do we intervene at all? We might ask, what the hell are the sheep doing there? Why attempt to protect the sheep from wolf attack and not the elk or the deer and so on? If we're concerned about the moral issues of predation, then surely there's no difference between a deer and a sheep. Both are victims. If we're troubled by the exploitation inherent in animal husbandry, then doesn't a sheep killed and consumed by a wolf au naturel become preferable to being hauled off to a slaughterhouse? Of course, we're not absolved of moral responsibility even then, as we put the sheep, to some extent the wolves, there in the first place. Maybe we should take a leap. Oh, there's some wild ungulates of the Mercantour, just to give you an idea of what the natural prey, if you like, of the wolves would be. I'm not very good with my slides, apologies. But, you know, maybe we ought to take a leaf out of that famous book by Mrs. Fisher. She was known, a famous and much-loved US cookery book from the 1940s, How to Cook a Wolf. I got this out of the library, went through it page by page, because she doesn't give any recipe about how to cook a wolf. It's merely metaphorical. But anyway, I'm going to end in a minute. The arrival of the wolves then in southeast France has altered the balance between non-human suffering and human benefit. More animals, numerically, both wild and domesticated, it would seem, now suffer as a result of the presence of the wolves than before they came, either due to being killed directly or from the psychological and behavioural consequences of predation. Humans, with the obvious exception of the sheep farmers, benefit from the enhanced ecological and imaginary status of the wolves that they bring to these areas, making the whole endeavour nakedly anthropocentrist, a cold-blooded manipulation of animal lives. Wolves, it would seem, always seem to expose the multiple inherent paradoxes in human-animal relations. And I love this quote from the Idaho Wool Growers Association. Wolves get into livestock, we kill the wolves, and that works well. We're not going to just let the wolves run wild. I love that, because running wild and eating sheep is what wolves do. So, should the wild wolves be killing the domesticated sheep? I mean, the situation is sort of inversely analogous to the killing of wild birds by domestic cats, and there's a wonderful recent article in Nature which claims that the killing of wild animals by cats, domestic cats, is the single greatest source of anthropogenic mortality in the US, birds and mammals. Cat owners, of course, are reluctant to keep cats indoors when they have the possibility to go outside, and indeed, to do so would perhaps be unkind and would constrain what is often alluded to as their, quote, natural instinct. Owners are reluctant to recognise the cold-blooded impact of their pet animals on local wildlife. So for cats, as for wolves, we might ask, what is a predator without predation? Our concerns then are not for animals per se, but for categories of animals, farm animals, pet animals, wild animals, and so on. By creating those categorizations, as we see in so many examples that we heard earlier, we give ourselves the liberty to change the rules each time. The result, to paraphrase Voltaire, tant pis pour les moutons, in other words, too bad for the sheep. That's it, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Henry. Time for questions. Yes.
I'm one of those poor sods who spent the summer collecting wolf scats.
Oh, were you? Oh, great.
And part of that also involved engaging with shepherds and hunters and being chased and persecuted by their sheepdogs as well.
Yeah, you had that.
It's genuinely terrifying.
It really is.
but it was quite interesting. It's more of an anecdote rather than a question, but it's quite interesting in Romania because I guess they've always had wolves, they've always had the presence of large carnivores. And they've gone through sort of quite a sort of complicated history relevant to the politics and sort of folk changes in Romania, but there seems to be a sort of sense of, you know, rather than Western Europe where it's sort of wild is perhaps more like, you know, our wild in Romania, it still seemed like a lot of places, people in rural places, sort of wild as, you know, like their wild belonging to wolves and bears. And so, sort of shepherds who suffered depredation by wolves actually were quite sort of ambivalent towards it, and one or two, there wasn't really a sort of moral judgment about the wolf. This is what they do. You know, we're where they are. But then when there was surplus killing, and sort of 10 or 20 or 30, then this was seen as immoral. So then it was like, you know, why are they doing this? Why would they sort of kill all of these? And then it's sort of the conflict sort of started to be sort of drawn out from that point. So.
No, I mean, I completely agree. As an anecdote, it's very good. I mean, the whole point about the French wild is that it is this very reconfigured, mediated form of wildness, and the wolves weren't there 30 years ago, so they've kind of reintroduced them. Whereas, as you say, if you go to Sweden or Romania or somewhere, or even Spain, actually, where the wolf presence has been there for some time, there isn't that sense of conflict so much.
Wolves kill their prey because they must, part of their fuel, their species being, they have no choice. Humans obviously kill for all kinds of reasons, none of them having to do with the species being. We have systems of justice when people kill, when that's supposed to, and more you're supposed to, but otherwise you're not. Do wolves, we should expect them to, if we want to have them be moral creatures. They ought to have an internal system of punishments for violations. So killing 10 sheep would seem to be wrong. Do we have any evidence that they discipline those who go out of control?
Yeah, they shoot.
No. Wolves.
Oh, I see.
Wolves.
I don't know, to be honest. I'd be amazed if they did.
Because wolves are very, they're very, I say they're smart, it's ridiculous, but they have a clear set of rules within the community.
Yeah.
Not so much hierarchies, they're rather democratic, I understand, but there are rules about misbehaving. Mm. So one wonders whether there is a system of justice that operates that we're not privy to.
Yeah. I mean, certainly this issue that I've been fascinated by, they found out about it in Sweden, where they're currently shooting quite a lot of wolves, is that they have either intentionally or accidentally shot pack leaders.
Right.
And the result is a kind of behavioural mismatch then takes place. And as I said, the group will fragment, and then the fragmented group will kill far more than if it had been a single group with a single pack leader. And whether that's deviant or right. simply the reduction or change in the hierarchy, I don't right. know.
In response to your comment about this being a concern for categories of animals, I couldn't help thinking that really this is not about, yes, this is about a category, a concern for a category of animals. It's not about the sheep, it's about people, which is implied by...
Yes, and in fact, I think I meant that really. It's about the people and the categories that we impose. Yeah. Yeah.
And so often this is... reminded me of an argument between a father and an art student daughter who objected to the Siamese cats in one of the Disney movies.
The Aristocats? He says, knowledge of Disney films.
She said it was racist, and he said, no, you're ridiculous, it's racist, and I kept out of it, but it's not about Siamese cats, it's about
No, but I think the categories thing, I mean, it links beautifully to what you were saying, it's like, you know, how we set up a set of different moral rules and behaviours, if we're talking about lab animals and pet animals and farm animals. I mean, I think it's quite an obvious point that you know, I was making, really, but this whole wolf issue has brought it home to me. You know, just this idea, and it came out in the newspapers last week, about there's a lovely article with Temple Grandin in The Guardian, and she raises the issue about surely it's preferable to kill cattle, you know, humane slaughter facility than the let them be ripped apart by a cougar. That's the heart of the debate.
It's about the dishonesty. Sorry, that's what I actually was. It's about the lack of knowledge of what it actually is.
Erica and then Jonathan.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me is go back historically. I think the point you made about as the sheep walk closer to the human habitat to keep an eye on them, the wolves will then come in closer. I think back in the 16th, 17th century, what that produces is werewolves. Mm. And to go back to where you started with the idea of the cold and hot-blooded, and is there a difference with what humans do, is actually, ironically, the narrative of the werewolf, if it's coming from that closeness of the animals that are being predated, that brings the wolves into the human community, yeah. is you give the wolves human power,
yeah.
which is that they transform. And that's what makes them really dangerous, is they've got human brains in animal bodies. And so they are like humans with no rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just strikes me as that then makes the cold-blooded come back to us.
Yeah, yeah. That's lovely.
So you're talking about categories of animals making moral judgments. I'm just wondering whether part of what is missing in this is, doesn't this essentially boil down to property rights in terms of claims of ownership? Because I've been looking at the introduction of beavers into Scotland, and a lot of moral arguments are made in terms of the wildness of beavers.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, it boils down to whether a beaver floods some prime agricultural land. So I'm wondering if that relationship of making moral judgments is really a way of kind of masking the real nub of this, which is about making compensatory claims over the taking of property, private property.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to exclude that from this notion of categories. The category of farmed animal is chattel, is own object that belongs to a person who is then compensated. No, absolutely. Anecdotally, of course, there's always the debate that these figures are artificially inflated by the farmers who want the extra compensation claim. So it all comes down to money again for a lot of these debates. But there are other people who claim that the National Park Authority ought to be reimbursed for the loss of some of the wild ungulates. You know, I think, yes, the ownership is inherent in the notion of categorisation. We're dodging it, really, but I agree with you.
Just last question. Yeah.
It's about, I don't know if I understand if you are asking about a kind of multi-species moral that could be shared by every species, because it's impossible. But practically, what happens in Africa, for instance, is that national parks, they have electric fences with a very low energy, and then lions, for instance, they don't prey out of the park. And so you are describing a situation where there are no restrictions for the wolves.
Yeah.
It's by choice. It's because they choose.
Well, yeah, I mean, just the detail. I mean, in the Mercantile National Park, they tried fencing them in, but it's impossible, largely because no one's ever seen them. You know, it's very difficult to know where they are a lot of the time, so you may put a fence and find that you've actually fenced a bit where there aren't the wolves. So it's become impractical to try and physically constrain them, which is why they've had this extraordinary movement. In 12 years, they've gone right up into the Vosges Mountains. There's even been reports, I don't know if you've ever driven down to Marseille, you've got that huge big motorway, that two or three carcasses of wolves have been found on the motorway that have been hit by cars. So their spread has been extraordinary because there's no physical restraint at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Henry.
Sure.
Thank you for the... I'm going to attempt to keep rigidly to time here, so thank you for keeping to time, Henry. Our next speaker is Catherine Halliday from York St John University. Where are you going? So Catherine is in the second year of her PhD in creative writing, and she's going to be talking today about Blood Cities, Animal Victims in Mad Adam and Zoo City.
Thank you.